Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell in the studio, along this week with Russell Chianelli. And we're going to be talking about astronomy. We're going to be talking about what used to be called Planet X. That is, for centuries, people have sort of speculated that in our solar system, there was things out there beyond the furthest ones away, which now we think of as Pluto, even though it has now been relegated to
a minor role.
A minor role, a planetoid or something like that. But anyway, so Russell and I know nothing about the stars, except we can find our way home after a session by using the North Star. But we have on the radio today, on the studio, on air with us, Mike Brown, who is a professor of astronomy at Caltech, and who has just been doing some really interesting things about what now we call Planet Nine. That is what used to be called Planet X. Some big planet out there, which is part of our planetary system. So, Mike, are you there? Jolly good. So, welcome to Science Studio, first of all. And before we get into astronomy, before we get into Planet X or 9 or whatever is out there beyond Pluto, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you become a scientist? How did you become an astronomer?
I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama, northern Alabama, in the early 70s. And of course, this is the time when the Apollo rockets were being built and going to the moon. And those Apollo rockets, the Saturn V's, were built, most of them, in Huntsville. So I lived in a town that was space town from early on, and I could hear the rocket tests. You could kind of feel the ground shake. I live in California now, so I'm used to feeling the ground shake. But back then, it was because there were rockets that were being tested. And what amazes me is not that I then became a scientist, but how did every kid who grew up right there not go and become a scientist? Because it was tremendously exciting to think about people going into space, to think about rockets, to think about astronomy. Indeed, many of my other friends from growing up in that time went and became mostly engineers who then worked on things like rockets and other stuff.
Did you ever meet Bonnie Dunbar? I was down there where you're talking about, and I met her and we interviewed her a long time ago. When the Challenger blew up, I invited her to the AMR Materials Research and Society meeting, and I called her up and I said, well, you must feel pretty bad now, because they all watched down there. And she said, no, I'm coming. And she went up on stage. There's about 500 people, and I introduced her, and she started saying ever since she was a little girl, she wanted to go up in a rocket, and she didn't care if there was a risk of blowing up. And by the time she got finished with her introduction, everybody in the audience was crying.
The city of Huntsville took those disasters quite hard and felt personally responsible. I know it was a difficult time for everyone around there.
So then growing up, you had that understanding of rocketry and astronomy and space travel. Did you ever think of going into the NASA program to be, in fact, go into space yourself?
I can't imagine that any kid around there didn't have that dream. I really did. So I really wanted to be an astronaut before I wanted to do anything else. And, you know, I feel like now I got the first five letters correct if I'm just an astronomer instead. In the end, I think for whatever reason, I ended up liking the science of the stars and space more than the engineering of building the rockets. Partially it's because I'm a terrible engineer and I try to build things and they all fall apart. But I'm pretty good at looking at things and trying to understand what's actually going on out there. So there's some just difference in, you know, the way a brain works between engineers and scientists and artists and everything. And so that just happened to be what I was better at.
And did you then try to apply that straight away into astronomy? And did you go to undergraduate school to study astronomy?
No, I was pretty convinced that you couldn't actually be an astronomer when you grew up. I mean, that's kind of a pipe dream. And so I liked science. I really liked physics when I was in eighth grade. And in eighth grade, physics means working on levers and pulleys and figuring out that if you have a really big lever, you can move things and you can calculate how much. And I thought, I want to be a physicist because I want to calculate levers and pulleys all day long, because I just thought that was the most amazing thing you could do. And so I went into physics as an undergraduate. Turns out you don't really calculate many levers and pulleys, but it's even more interesting than levers and pulleys. But I kept on taking side classes in astronomy because I really, really liked astronomy, but I didn't think I was going to do it. And then as I was thinking about going to graduate school, one of my professors, I was asking him for a recommendation, and I told him I was going to go to graduate school in physics, and he knew about my interest in astronomy. And he said, why are you going into physics? Why not go into astronomy, which is what you really want to do? And it turns out sometimes you just need that one person to say that, to say it's okay. No one had ever told me it was okay before. I didn't know anybody who was an astronomer or a professor of anything. And so to have somebody say it was okay was all it took. So I went to graduate school in astronomy, got my PhD in astronomy, and stayed ever since.
Your parents, did they have any words of wisdom for you when you were choosing a career? They'd have preferred you to be an engineer, maybe?
My father was an engineer, which is why we lived there in Huntsville. He was working on the Apollo program and on the space shuttle. He certainly didn't try to get me to be an engineer, although he helped sometimes thinking through what I should be doing. But really, they never tried to put me in any particular direction.
That's very nice. So then, what direction did you take? When you got to graduate school, you're now finding yourself studying astronomy. What were your first issues? What were the first problems that you were interested in and guided towards, perhaps?
Well, so the very first thing I ever worked on actually changed everything that I thought about astronomy, and this is kind of amazing to think about this myself. I haven't really thought about this in a while, but I went into astronomy wanting to study the most distant things that we could find in the universe. In many ways, astronomy, certainly then, not as much now, but back then...
Could you rephrase it another way? Hey, what's out there?
It was not just what's out there. It's just I wanted to study the most distant things. And that's how astronomers kind of sorted themselves. The people who studied the most distant things were the cool kids. And, so that's like galaxies at the edge of the universe. And if you studied nearby galaxies, you were okay. And if you studied stars, that was pretty mundane. And if you studied planets, that was the dregs. There's nothing worse than somebody who studies, like, why do you even need a telescope? You can see these things in the sky all by yourself. And yet, my advisor, High Spinrad, who I went to work with because he studied the most distant galaxies in the world, in the universe, he has had this idea that he liked comets, too. He just thought they were kind of interesting, and so sometimes when he was out at the telescope working on his galaxies, if there was a bright comet around, he would swing the telescope to take a look at the comet and study its composition and how it got there and stuff. And so when I arrived, my very first summer that I arrived at the University of California, Berkeley, there was a bright comet. I was working with High Spinrad, and I wanted to work on galaxies, but a bright comet came by, and he said, well, okay, so you can work on galaxies later, but first let's go work on this one comet. And that was it. From that moment on, I have stayed within our solar system. I think the moment that really cemented me was standing at the telescope. This is the big 3-meter telescope at Lick Observatory above San Jose. And the telescope in the morning swung around to the comet. And we had been looking at galaxies all night. But when it swung around to the comet, I went and stood in the big dome where the telescope was. And I looked up the barrel of the telescope. And I could barely see this little fuzzy comet that was right there. And as opposed to the galaxies that we'd be looking at all night, there's no way you could see them. They're so faint that you can barely see them with the telescope. This comet was real. It was visceral. And I've loved that about the solar system ever since, and I've never looked back.
That's interesting. So you say you wanted to study this through the telescope, the comet, but what particularly were you looking at? Were you looking at trying to make out some chemical composition from emission, or what was the actual tool of science that you were using, and what information?
You're exactly right. We were actually trying to understand the chemical composition by looking at the light coming from it and breaking that light up into really, really fine parts to look to see if we could find some small chemical species that no one had noticed before. And the reason for doing this was, one, it was a bright telescope, so a bright comet, so we could break it up quite nicely. But also there was this brand new instrument that had gone on the telescope just recently before I had arrived, and no one had ever used it to look at comets before. And that's, in many ways, that's always an exciting thing to do, use a new instrument that no one's used before to look at something, and you're bound to find interesting new things. And we certainly did. We found all sorts of emissions coming from the comet that had never been seen before.
So, in fact, that hits on two things. One is that a lot of people think science is often made by, scientists sitting down and thinking and planning an experiment. But a lot of good science comes from engineers and physicists who create new instruments that give us the chance to make new discoveries. So what molecules did you find in this comet that weren't known before?
Oh, boy. So you're asking me about something that happened 25 years ago, so I'm not sure I remember the answer.
But you're a professor of astronomy, my goodness, man. You've got a memory.
Well, I can tell you. So I'm thinking now in the shorter part of the wavelength range, there was this whole clump of emission from carbon, but it's this carbon with three atoms of carbon stuck together, which is a funny thing that you can't really do on the Earth. You can't get three carbons stuck together for very long. They react with something else and go away. But in comets, there's nothing else around. So if you just happen to have three carbons stuck together, they stay there. You can see ions of carbon monoxide. We could see ammonia, but ammonia with one of the hydrogen atoms knocked off. So the interesting thing was all this chemistry that we were seeing that doesn't happen on the Earth, because nowhere on the Earth is there a vacuum as good as the vacuum that is even in the atmosphere. A comet is a better vacuum than what's on the Earth.
Do you remember if you found hydrocarbons? Was methane out there at all?
Unfortunately, we couldn't see those molecules at the wavelengths we were looking.
Okay.
We were looking instead at wavelengths that tended to have more of these really weird radical species. They're called these things that are not supposed to be around. I guess that's why they call them radicals, but that you can find.
You know, there's so many interesting questions. Which planet, I just was reading, one planet has rivers and lakes of liquid methane.
Yeah, that's Titan, not a planet, but a moon
of
Saturn.
So it makes you wonder whether life could evolve in, methane.
It's something that people are really excited about, and you can come up with ideas of how life would indeed work in methane, what kind of membranes it would use in the same way that we use cells to hold our liquids together. People have hypothesized how you would do it. The people have hypothesized what kind of respiration they would have and what kind of signatures they would make in the atmosphere. And there have even been hints on Titan that when the Huygens probe went down into Titan's atmosphere.
Oh, yes.
Boy, how long ago was that now? 15 years ago? I'm going to forget the nut, but it was a long time ago now. It measured the atmospheric composition on the way down, and there was this hint that as it got right near the bottom, that suddenly the molecular hydrogen was disappearing in a weird way, and
mm-hmm.
people have speculated that maybe it's because it's part of a respiratory system. That
mm-hmm.
seems like a pretty out there speculation, but you know, it just shows you that people are thinking about these
absolutely
sorts of
things. I mean, that's exactly where science is. You know, you see something that you're not expecting, and all the hypotheses start to come out.
Yeah.
And then we try to get experimental data for them.
That's exactly right.
So here you are, you're studying comets, the closest things in fact to the Earth at that time, almost, instead of way out there. So when you became your independent career, what were you looking at then? And then let's take a break and come back and talk about your interest in Planet Nine.
When I arrived at Caltech as a young assistant professor, I had worked on comets. I had worked on other things in the solar system. I'd worked on the moons of Jupiter and volcanoes on the moon Io and how that interacted with Jupiter. So all these very specific, very, very solar system questions. And when I arrived at Caltech, I realized that I suddenly had these opportunities that I hadn't had before, which is that Caltech had and still has an extraordinary amount of access to very large telescopes. And having that access to those large telescopes meant that I could look at things that are fainter than most people could. And at that point, I realized that there had been this new discovery of objects out beyond the orbit of Neptune in what we now call the Kuiper Belt. And in fact, Pluto is part of this Kuiper Belt. And that these tiny objects out beyond Neptune were essentially remnants left over from the formation of the solar system. And they'd been in deep freeze for the past 4.5 billion years. So studying these was going to be, it seemed clear at the time, that studying these was going to give amazing insights into the formation of our solar system. And I thought to myself, this is it. This is what I really need to be doing now that I'm here, now that I can look at these very, very faint objects at the edge of our solar system.
That's good. So we'll come back after a short break and find out exactly what you've learned. You're listening to Science Studio. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, and Mike Brown from Caltech, professor of astronomy. And so, Mike, you were saying that, you know, now you've sort of arrived at one of the pinnacles of scientific research locations in the world. You have access to things that lots of people do not have access to, and you're interested in the Kuiper Belt. What's way, way out there? And, of course, there's been speculation, as I alluded to at the beginning, for centuries, that there was maybe another sun out there, but it wasn't the sun. It was just never quite got hot enough to be a sun or whatever the word is. Because a lot of suns I gather, or a lot of stars, are binary. So there's always a thought that maybe there was a black half of the binary of our sun with something else. That was Planet X. So how did you go about getting involved in discerning what you could about this possibility of the ninth planet?
So that it's been a very long-term evolution, but it really does start with the ideas of what is out there on the edge of the solar system. And you're right, ever since Neptune was discovered in 1845, people have been wondering what else is out there beyond Neptune. And so the idea that there is this Planet X beyond Neptune has been rattling around for a long time. But Planet X was always supposed to be some massive object that's perturbing the orbit of Neptune, pulling Neptune along. And by the early 90s, it was clear that there is no such thing as Planet X. Neptune is not being perturbed at all. Neptune goes just where it's supposed to go. And that was kind of, in many ways, when I started looking at the outer solar system, the door had been shut on Planet X. There is no Planet X out there. There are no other stars in orbit around the sun. That was all pretty well understood by the time I had started here at Caltech. But what was known is that beyond Neptune, there was this vast belt of small bodies. It's kind of like the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter is full of all these little rocky bodies. Out beyond Neptune is another belt full of little icy bodies, and now we have seen one of them up close, Pluto, but there are many, many thousands of other ones out there. But at the time, when I started, I don't remember how many there were. There might have been maybe 30 or 50 of them known. And so it was clear to me that studying the ones that were known and finding new ones to study going to be an important thing over the next couple of years. And the other thing that was clear was that once you realize that there are many objects out there, you also realize that the fact that Pluto was the biggest one that was known is probably just an accident of where it happened to be at the time. And probably there would be other big things out there in the Kuiper Belt. So 15 years ago, maybe, gosh, 20 years ago now, I really started trying hard to find out what else was out there in the outer part of the solar system that was, you know, sort of at the same size scale as Pluto. And the reasons were that I really felt like that Pluto itself and then any of these other ones all contained clues about the history of the solar system, about things like collisions that had taken place, the chemistry of things out there. But at the time, Pluto was the only one that was bright enough to study in detail, and so we didn't know very much. And so if we could find more bright objects that we could study in detail, then we can learn so much more about the outer part of the solar system.
So what did you discover?
We spent about 10 years systematically scanning the skies, looking for other objects in the vicinity of Pluto, and we found many dozens of objects, but we found probably the 15 or so of the top 20 biggest objects that we know of out there in the Kuiper Belt, including Eris, which is the one that's more massive than Pluto out there in the region of Pluto. It's about 25% more massive than Pluto and has all sorts of interesting history that you can read from looking at its surface and looking at the light coming off of it. We found Eris. We found this crazy one called Haumea, which is shaped kind of like a football that's been deflated and stepped on, and it's rotating end over end every 4 hours, and it's got a pair of moons that are chunks that have flown off of it, and also about a dozen chunks of it have flown off into space that are also now in orbit around the sun. So you can use that to try to reconstruct collisions that happened and the geophysics of what happened.
Are there some of those pieces that were flown off, sort of like moons for these particular new objects?
So in this particular case, in the case of Haumea, the two moons that it has are chunks of the surface that used to be there that have flown off. And then the dozen, and I'm sure hundreds of other objects that are out there are out there.
Well, what about Planet Nine? It says here, I'm looking at a news article, that it's been spotted, but it's too far away to be spotted directly.
Okay, so look, this is all about 10 years before Planet Nine. So Planet Nine was slow in coming, and it really required all of this early work, during which time we did not think there was another planet out there. We were really convinced that we were defining the outer edge of the solar system, finding the largest things out there, but that was it, that Neptune was the last planet, and everything else was kind of this debris belt that was going to be out there. With the first hint, even though we didn't know it at the time, the first hint that there was something else out there came from one of our discoveries, an object that we call Sedna, which it was fascinating because rather than being part of this belt of objects in beyond Neptune, its orbit looks like it's been pulled further away from the belt by something. In fact, its orbit requires that it's been pulled away by something. But we had no idea what that something was. And our original ideas were that, well, this is probably something that happened in the distant past. Maybe a star came by and pulled Sedna out. And we certainly didn't think it had anything to do with, you know, a planet in the outer part of the solar system, because all of those ideas had been basically discredited by the 1990s. But we then kept finding, we and other people, kept finding more and more of these objects that looked like they had been pulled away from the Kuiper belt. And the final straw was that all of these objects essentially looked like they had been pulled in the same direction. And you can't do that if you did it 4 billion years ago, because if they'd all gotten pulled in the same direction 4 billion years ago, by now their directions would have been pointing in randomly around the sky because things rattle around enough over 4 billion years. The fact that they were all being pulled in the same direction right now said to us there must be something out there right now in the sky that's pulling these things, pulling the orbit.
10 times as massive as the Earth.
So we then, once we realized there had to be something there, we started a long series of calculations and computer simulations to try to figure out what could be doing it. And that was the answer. The answer was the only thing that works, that can make a signature that's this big, has to be something like 10 times the mass of the Earth and something like 10 times further away than Neptune. So a huge planet out there. This is not like a, you know, slightly bigger than Pluto and we'll sit around and argue whether it's a planet or not. This is 5,000 times more massive than Pluto. It's a planet that's approaching the size of Neptune, and it's just in the much more distant part of the solar system.
And we don't see it because it's just so far from our sun, so that there's not enough light getting there to reflect for us to be able to observe.
So there is enough light to reflect if we knew where it was. Once we find it, we'll be able to study it in gory detail. So the problem is that we can constrain where it is. We have a swath of sky somewhere, but now we have to go and use the biggest telescopes that we have here on the ground to do detailed studies of that swath of sky to find that one faint object that's moving very slowly across the sky that's Planet Nine. So that's going to be a long-term study. It might take a year or two before we finish that swath of sky. But when we do, we will have, you know, right now we know it's there because of its gravitational signature, but we still want to pinpoint where it is so we can study it in gory detail.
Two things come out of that. One is the fact that it's going to take a long time. And then you said, you know, 1 or 2 years. It's just a different time scale from astronomy generally. And the other thing was that I was interested to know whether now there's a big collaboration with all the big telescopes around the world, so that each telescope will be assigned a certain time of day or the
looking
night
for it.
To look for it, so that, in fact, this is now a big collaborative search as opposed to somebody trying to find great glory by being the first one to see them using their own telescope.
Yeah, I'd say it's more the latter than the former. So everybody wants to find it because this is the third time a planet has been discovered in human history. That's a pretty amazing thing to get to be the first person to find it. Many different people are trying in many different ways. And that's actually the exciting part, is that different astronomers have different specialties, have access to different things, and so they can all try in different ways and try to see if they can find it. We have tried very hard to help everybody that we can. Don't get me wrong, I would love to be the person who finds it myself. I am perfectly happy to help every other group that's out there by, you know, showing our calculations of where we think it is, looking, helping them to figure out the range of what they need to be looking at. So we've been very systematically doing all that. I suspect that we will not be the ones to find it, just because I think there are probably a dozen different groups looking, and so our chances are only 1 in 12, but somebody will. I hope it happens very soon.
I'd like to take you back to comets and asteroids. I teach a course about synchrotrons, and some of the students in there were telling me that they have a project which they're going to get platinum, iridium, and the noble metals from comets and asteroids. Have you ever heard of that?
People talk about that. I think it's crazy, but they talk about it. I don't believe that it is economically viable to mine anything in space and bring it back to Earth. It just doesn't seem plausibly viable. The only case that I've ever seen that's even modestly convincing, and I emphasize modestly, is people who talk about mining asteroids not for their minerals but for their water and using that water in space for things like fuel.
Yeah.
You could imagine that if there were ever a big spacefaring civilization, that might be an important thing. I tend to be more skeptical of a lot of the what I think of as kind of pie-in-the-sky space ideas. Everybody loves space. I don't blame people for loving space. Sometimes I kind of feel like just saying the word space makes people's eyes kind of get wide. And
I wonder about it because I've always, related to everything you're saying. I remember when Soviets put up their satellites and how scary that was. And I also, and I wonder whether you did this, I was down in Mexico looking at it to see where the Great Impactor hit. Reading about the Great Impactor. Have you ever been there?
No, I've never been there.
Oh, it's worth it.
You know, even just standing, I've been in Meteor Crater in northern Arizona, and just standing on the side of that crater and looking down is a pretty spectacular sight, too. There's a lot out there, a lot that comes. We need to spend our efforts trying to...
There's not one out there we got to worry about this week?
Or this year or this century, I don't think.
That's good news.
The only good news this week.
I was going to say the same. Russell would shoot me dirty looks. But it is. It's the only good piece of news this week. And I'd like to thank you, Mike Brown, for doing it. But you really do believe in the end. Just it's a couple of years before it's detected.
I do think so. Everyone else other than me should remain skeptical of these sorts of things. It's a difficult calculation, and other astronomers are working hard to reproduce or shoot down or something else our calculations, but we are pretty confident that it's there and that we're going to find it.
Well, Mike Brown, Caltech, thank you very much for being on Science Studio.
Thanks to our producer, Kimberly.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Okay, take care. And we'd like to thank the audience out there, as usual, and we will be back next week with some other topic in science, so make sure you're there as well as we are. Take care.